Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Lucas Hyde podcast. And it is time, as usual on Wednesday, well, not as usual because I mix up the Wednesday shows, but this Wednesday it is time for the long cast, and we are on episode 45, part 2, with Andrew Cow. And again, I can't thank Andrew enough for coming on. This episode's awesome. It was a lot of fun recording with him last week. If you didn't check out part one, I'd recommend checking out part one. It was just a fun conversation talking about board games and stuff. And it's not necessarily a prerequisite for today's part two, but it'll definitely, if you haven't listened to me and Andrew before, it'll definitely give you a feel for how we talk and the things we like to talk about. This week, we talk a lot about SmashCon because we did record this right after SmashCon, how fun it was and all of the stuff that happened there, the cool things that happened, our opinions on some of the games there, especially Melee and why we like Melee. And then after that, we talk a little bit about one of Andrew's favorite games, Half-Life 2. If you have not played the Half-Life games, they are a staple in video gaming. I actually have not played them, so it's quite embarrassing for me to say, but they're staple in video gaming. They are historical, especially Half-Life 1. So we talk a little bit about the differences of AI, and Andrew mainly talks about it because I don't know the differences too much, so I got to learn a lot about why those games are so special, and it's just a fun conversation. All right, everybody, without further ado, here is my episode with Andrew Cow. Enjoy, everybody. Bye.
Close properly.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. We're back.
We are back.
But you just had your, as we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You had your come to Jesus moment with Melee. How does that feel? I'm really excited, by the way. I have a big smile on my face right
now.
Yeah. Because I love Melee. And especially recently, because I've gotten a lot better recently.
Yeah.
But I want to hear why you, how you got to where you are now. Because you seem to have the fire now where you're like, Melee's good, man. I want to get better. What happened?
So I don't really, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Real quick, for the people who don't know, Andrew was one of the people that we went on the SmashCon trip with. And this... go talk about Melee first. We'll talk about SmashCon because I think this was the best SmashCon trip.
Yeah. So the thing about, I think, a lot of games or a lot of things and a lot of activities is that you can't tell how impressive something is unless you yourself understand the context. And a good example is that I think there's one Street Fighter clip, like a top pro. I don't know who the characters are or who the two players were because I'm not a Street Fighter character.
Yeah.
But I just remember that there's one scene where character A like punches character B who had like no health left in her health bar. And for some reason, character A, like even though he punched, character B took no damage, right? So he punched again, character B took no damage. He punched again, character B took no damage. And this happened like 5 times. And while this was happening, everyone in the audience was just going apeshit.
I think like, you're, are you thinking of the Daigo set?
Maybe.
This is a very famous set that I actually show people often to describe why I think people enjoy Melee as a... I'm not saying people don't enjoy Street Fighter, but for me personally, why Melee visually as a as a spectator, I think is more enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
But so in the Daigo set, what happens is I believe it's Daigo, but he is on the like his last health. One hit's gonna kill him.
Like his health bar looks empty.
Yeah, and the person he's fighting, I forget who it is. Forgive me, but he does a super move. I believe it's called just a super. And,
yeah.
Or it might be totally wrong. He does a special move. We'll call it a special move.
Yeah.
And it has 30 hits in it. And you have to, in order to have survived, what he has to do is perfectly block 30 hits in a row. And he does it. And he comes back and wins.
Yeah, and the time for blocking is very tight,
very small window.
Yeah.
It's only several frames, I believe.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Everybody was losing their mind, but keep going.
So the problem is that here's one of the most hype scenes in any fighting game.
in fighting game history. Yeah. It's one of the hypest moments ever.
I watched that, and I'm not impressed at all because I don't understand the context of what is going on. And it's like that with other games, too. I'm a Dota player. My friends show me amazing League clips, and I kind of get a feeling of how impressive it is because at the end, one team is, like, completely dead.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, how hard was that strategy to execute.
How hard was it to execute? And you can imagine, you can kind of say, oh, it was really difficult.
Yeah.
You can say, oh, yeah, that was super hard. But you have no barometer.
Yeah.
You have to play a lot of Dota. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to play a lot of Dota to, as, like, a spectator to understand. Like, so I've played a fair amount of Dota. Mm-hmm. But this is why I also think CS is better this way, because visually I think it's just easier to understand, is that you shoot the guy, it works, he dies.
Yeah.
You know?
But so the problem in Melee is that I have very bad reaction time or very bad, like, visual processing in terms of speed, right? So the problem is that why I watch a lot of Melee clips, I'm imagining in Dragon Ball, whenever Goku fights another high-level
that's
villain.
That's a really famous Melee clip, actually.
Everyone, I'm like the guy in the sideline saying,
I'll have to show you that video. It's a, I know what you're going to say, but it's a funny Melee clip where he goes, what's going on? What's happening? And he's like, they're moving super fast. You have to see their energies. And then he's like, open your mind. And then what happens is Goku like closes, or Gohan closes his eyes, and he's like, I think I can hear them. And then he like opens his eyes, and, all you hear is blip, blip. It's like The Shines. Because it said, I think it was like the joke was Smash 4 players coming to Melee.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait, what? What's happening? Blip, blip, blip. And then all of a sudden it's this fox doing like these crazy wave shine combos. And he's like, oh my God, I can see them. Like, I can see what's happening. It's crazy.
No. So that's like the problem. I'm like the guy in the sideline where when I watch a Melee game, I am just baffled because they're moving so quick and I can't keep up. And when I play Melee, unfortunately, I play with Lucas and his younger brother Andre and our friends Mikey and other people. They are way better than me. So when you play, it's kind of frustrating because you don't really know what's going on. You're just saying, oh, hey, I move to the left, I lose my life. I move, go to the right, I lose my life. I jump, I lose my life. I stand still, I lose my life. And the problem is that I couldn't process as fast enough. It was just frustrating.
It's hard to know. And the thing is with Melee is that the skill floor is so high.
Yeah.
The skill ceiling is also very high. Is that if you have a play, and the same thing in CS, I think, too.
Yeah.
Is that, and that's why people get stuck in silver forever. The same for me, is that the skill floor is very high, and there's a lot to know, a lot of knowledge to be had there. But when you are playing a player that is of better skill, more often than not, that player will win.
Yeah.
It's so, very likely that player will win.
Yeah. Now, that
which
was
is
just
why wobbling sucks. But keep going. You good? But that's one of the reasons I don't like wobbling.
So I come back to Melee after a little bit.
Yeah, you didn't play it for a while.
Well, you know, school was kind of killing me.
Yeah, but it's hard to play games at school. And then a lot of people played Ultimate at school, right?
Yeah, but I come back to Melee. And I don't know like what like changed, but I just noticed a lot of subtleties coming up. For example, I noticed stuff like, wait, why move left and I die is different than how I die when I move right. You know what I mean? It wasn't just move left, die, move right, die. It was move left, go fall into combo A. Move right, fall into combo B.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that sort of like small subtlety came, I realized, wait, I'm not just dying like all the time like the same way. I'm actually dying different ways because my positioning affects how my opponent approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw that, that means that I know how my opponent is approaching. And once I know how my opponent is approaching, I can counter it.
Yeah.
I know what was going on. So a good example of that, when I used to play against you, Lucas,
mm-hmm.
you will pretty much you will easily four stock me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I came back, I realized I watched competitive Melee and played myself a little bit.
When you watch it a lot, too.
Yeah.
Especially watching it live.
Yeah.
This is one thing I'm going to take to the grave. It's faster live.
Watch it. Watch a pro player like right in front of you. When you hear the sounds of the controller,
yeah,
you realize just how in. Like
I'll never forget. There's two moments I'll never forget. I remember maybe my second or my first SmashCon, watching Mango play, and just going, "Holy shit, his Falco is so goddamn fast."
Yeah,
and I had been watching. I swear it's faster live. I don't know what it is about being in the moment, being there with everything. I don't know if it's the energy, but watching it on Twitch, it just doesn't feel as fast to me. Like I watch it and I go, or watching it on YouTube, and it's the same thing that happens to me for tennis. And then I go and I watch it live and I go, oh my God, it's faster.
Yeah.
Like it's way faster. And then watching Hungrybox at Genesis. Watching Hungrybox play Axe at Genesis, I believe. And I was just like, oh my God, he's so fast.
Axe or Hungrybox?
Hungrybox. And I, from that moment forth, I like had such a deep respect for him.
Yeah.
But, oh my God. It's so fast. But keep going.
So the thing is that, like, why, after doing all that, I looked at you, right? I looked at how you put it. I said, Lucas is a very aggressive player. Like, the reason why he's playing his way is, the reason why I'm dying is because why I make a movement mistake, Lucas is aggressive that he's always in a position to capitalize on that mistake. So that I tried to change my playstyle accordingly. I tried to play very defensive. I was considering, okay, when I walk in this direction, he's going to come at me like so. Can I bait him? Maybe like dash dance forward, bait you to try attack me, then do a shield, and then hopefully have an out shield option in order to punish you for that. If I was to jump, he has a better mobility, so he's going to like try to get me. So can I sort of like jump onto a platform in such a way that I'm just like, I force you like an extra movement in order to get close enough to hit me. And that extra movement is my window of timing where I can like fight you.
Yeah.
And you still like defeat me so easily. No.
Mm-hmm. But you've gotten a lot better though.
I feel like there's like a chance I have to come in, or like there's like, I sort of see a glimmer of like the steps I have to take in order to like beat you. And that was the, what made me appreciate Melee a lot more. There's so many intricacies in Melee with decision-making process that once you sort of see how option A leads to path A, which then leads to all these other potentials, hypothetical situations and combos, you realize just how deep and fast the game can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why I got into Melee a lot recently. I'm starting to see more of this. I'm starting to see why going left and going right, how those options just diverge into completely different games.
Yeah.
It helps me pretty much understand that. It's also probably the fact that I'm more focused on working on my focusing on the fundamentals too.
Yeah.
I think a problem a lot of people do in Melee when they try to come to it is that they practice all the tech first, like wave dashing, short hopping, shuffling, power shielding, because to them, like, they look at Melee, they read up on that, and they're like, ah, I can get that down. But the fundamentals are really important, because that's how you pretty much strategize from there. There's so much strategy going on. Is why I think my brother, he does not practice the mechanical stuff in Melee. From a technical perspective, you're way better than him. But he's not a bad player because he actually like focused on the fundamentals though. Yeah,
Brian has he has good fundamentals. Yeah, like, and good follow ups.
Yeah, like learning what is the neutral game like can really just help you improve your Melee playstyle. And I realized that the problem is that I was trying to focus on the technical cool stuff. Like I was a Doc player. Doc is cool. Doc is swagger. Okay.
I'm not going to deny. I lost to a Doc at SmashCon.
I mean, watching Shroom play that one, I still remember one of my favorite clip was Shroom was fighting a fox. He managed, I think, to grab the fox, and then I'm not sure if it was a down throw or a forward throw. It was one of those throws. And then Shroom proceeded to short hop up air, juggle the fox across Pokemon Stadium from like the right side to the left side, and then he ended it off with a forward there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, problems that, like, trying to practice that stuff first is horrible. Because that situation doesn't arise a lot.
Yeah.
So I was trying to practice all the cool tech stuff. And then it wasn't until I came back, I realized, hey, no, focus on the fundamentals. There's a lot of strategic subtleties you have during neutral that you have to like take advantage of. Because every character has like some weakness, except Fox, because Fox is a broken character and should be removed. Nah, I'm just kidding. No, but every character has like weakness and it is up to you to exploit that. I used to think Marth was overpowered because he had such a long range and such a like strong long range attack.
But the sword, man.
Yeah.
The sword.
But then you realize he has such a long, like all his moves have long wind up. And if he misses, he is so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to you to like take advantage of that in neutral. During neutral, you like try to bait him into forward smashing. When he forward smashes, you have like so much time to punish that.
Yeah,
because he just like it's like I don't know. It's like he ties his shoes after he smashes his sword on the ground or something. So that's like one reason why I developed a bigger appreciation for melee. Is my shift in focus from like cool technical flashy stuff to like the fundamentals,
mm-hmm.
learning how to think through neutral, how your opponent plays, and how you change it up according to that. Don't forget the flashy stuff too, because flashy stuff is badass. So remember sick. Why Ken comboed you?
Did you?
Yeah, I think it was on FD or Fox. I don't think it was a true Ken combo, but I think I like knocked you like down the ground. You bounced
I think
up.
I was bouncing off, and then you ran off and downed me. Right?
Yeah,
that was pretty sick.
Yeah, like
that was super sick.
No, but there's definitely an importance on the fundamentals too. Look at some of the professional Smash player PPMD. He wasn't like the most flashy guy, mm-hmm. but the reason why he was so good is because he played neutral very well.
Yeah,
and I'm very sad he goes away.
Yeah. He's streaming, though, which is good.
That's yeah. pretty dope.
I would like to see him come back. I believe he could do it. See, the thing is, for me, I believe he can do it because if he did it before,
yeah.
I believe he can do it again. He already knows what it's like, you know?
Yeah.
And, the landscape's different, but he obviously had the work ethic to get there before.
Yeah.
And I think he can do it again. It'd be exciting.
That's... Mm-hmm. You want to talk about SmashCon?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think this is the best SmashCon you had so far?
For me, this was the best SmashCon yet.
I concur wholeheartedly.
It was an amazing, amazing trip, wasn't it?
It was. I don't know, like, I can't describe like the exact reason why it was good. I can point to like a couple of like reasons why,
mm-hmm.
but it was one of those trips where like, you have to be there to like feel all of it.
It was such a good fucking tournament.
I know. Well, the tournament itself kind of sucked because, you know, top eight.
Top eight was trash, except for none IBDW.
No.
Oh my God. That was insane. He was reading him so bad, so hard. Andre and I have gone back and watched it a couple times already. Andre was popping off. He was like screaming in the crowd. It was crazy. It was. I can't even believe what he was doing. It looked like he could see the future.
I know.
It looked like he could see the future.
I love all the jokes on Reddit. It was like none packed up all his stuff, hired a company, moved straight into IBDW's head.
Yeah.
Just read, like, there's reading someone like an open book, and then there's literally having someone read their own book to you.
It was crazy. He wrote the book.
Yeah.
He wrote the book.
Yeah. It reminds me of that one scene in Naruto where Zabuza and Kakashi are fighting, and Zabuza's like, wait, how do you predict my move? He's like, no, you weren't copying me. I was copying you. No, that's sort of like weird anime ninja bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
No, but okay, I think there's several reasons why I like the Smash Con. Number A is that Jimmy was there.
Yeah.
Like,
I was so glad to have Jimmy there. It was so much fun.
Of the 3 years we've been to SmashCon, Jimmy left halfway through the first trip.
Which was a shame because Mango won it.
Yeah. And he completely did not go on the second trip.
Which was a hype one too. That was our mod of Mewtwo King.
I remember. So that's why it was good. Second reason was that everyone was into Melee.
Yeah. This was the most Melee-driven trip by far. I don't think we've had such a group. Like, so five people, that's a group.
Yeah.
Like, that's not just one or two players showing up. Like, we had a whole group. And all of us were on the friendly setups all the time.
Yeah.
I was so glad to see. It was almost like a training academy type thing. Like, we were training before, and then we went there, and everybody was obsessed about getting on friendly setups. It was awesome.
I know.
And everybody got so much better. Jimmy and you got so much better. It was crazy. It's crazy, isn't it?
It is.
Going to the tourney power-ups are wild. There's something different. There's nothing like a tourney power-up.
They are. I think another reason why this trip was good, and it's a bit more of a cruel, cynical one, is that we also all had more disposable income, which I think just gave us more like freedom to do stuff.
I spent more time like actually shopping around.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Because I don't know, because like I think the other 2 years, we never really did look at like the merchandise except just to make fun of them, because we're like, ha, look at how they're all just like weird, colorful cartoons.
I like the merchandise, but sometimes there's some weird, like let's keep this
podcast safe for work.
It was anime, but they had the naked secret ones that you could ask to see.
which is funny, but stuff like you really don't want to
it's
be
not
seen
something
by.
That yeah. like it's not something that I'm into, you know what I mean? So it's weird for me.
But I think like having more disposable income is like it's just like, you know, good because there's more stuff to do. You can take your time off Melee and then look at some just really cool stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't until like this year where I just realized a lot of the artwork actually has a lot of, as a guy inspiring to be like a decent drawler myself, there's like a lot of really cool techniques and styles I saw there.
There's that one person who actually showed you how they did it.
Yeah, it was like a rough sketch. So I think that's another reason why I like this Melee.
Mm-hmm.
What were some more of the reasons why this was the best Melee trip ever?
Well, everybody except you competed in Melee singles.
I did doubles.
You did doubles. Yeah. Next year, you have to compete in Melee singles.
Of course.
But everybody competed. It's so hyped seeing the homies compete. It's so much fun. I competed on stream.
That was wild. You actually did put up a decent fight. I mean,
I got four stock and three stocked.
Yeah,
but,
stocked, you put up a decent fight.
I think I talked about it on the podcast. Like, I think that if I had known the matchup a little bit better, and if I personally was a little bit better, it would have been much closer.
Yeah,
but that's like obviously just work and time that I have to put in. I wasn't beating him at this tournament. You know what I mean? Like, I was not good enough to beat him at this tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whatever. But I left it all out there, and I was really happy. And playing on stream was, that was awesome. Even though there was nobody watching, like,
I was watching.
Yeah, but there was like the seat. It's not even that the seats weren't full or anything. It's that I was just like on stream on stage.
Yeah,
man, I just felt so good. Like, that just felt so good to be up there. I can't even, I just, like, I sat down, I was like, I'm on stage.
It's like, how do I say it? It's like, so I guess, like, for a lot of people, like, they play Meditative competitively, but they're not, like, part of the competitive, like, scene, because they're not, like, that high level. But for a brief moment, you were in there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I just want it again, you know what I mean? Like, I just want to be on stage again.
Maybe during Genesis or Big House or Shine.
That would be cool. I have to put in a lot of work, which is what I'm excited for.
Yeah.
But I went 3-2, but I don't count the someone disqualified, so I only count it as 2-2. Same thing for Andre, he went 2-2. But he went 3-2 technically, but I only count the matches I win. Because I mean that's where you learn things. That was awesome. I lost to a doc. He was pretty good. He was pretty swag.
Yeah.
I got swagged on a little bit. I left the video on my website, actually, so that people can see me getting beat up by the Luigi. But he was a good player. There was that. Everybody, it was just so, again, like, I keep coming back to the fact that it was so Melee-centric.
Yeah.
Like, everything was about Melee. Like, the other tournaments that we went to, the other Smash Cons, like, I feel like we went there and we did some convention things, but this was like the first time we really just fully threw ourselves into it.
I mean,
like, the full convention mode. And then on top of that, we threw ourselves into the game that we love the most, which is Melee. And because we like did some other stuff last year, watching some of the other games. We didn't do any of that this year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I have no idea what happened for the other games because I was just so focused on Melee. And that's why it was, I think, honestly, because, I mean, that's the one I love. I really just committed to that game. I was like, I love this game. This is the game I love. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to commit to that. And that's why it was so much fun.
I think a good choice was to not bring the setup because that meant that we want our Melee fixed. We had to go play friendlies.
Yeah, I think it was a good choice. I think next year, like, it'd be nice to have in the hotel room, maybe. But really, realistically, we should be spending all day at the venue and getting our friendlies in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's really what we should be doing.
Yeah.
So honestly, I might not even do that anymore. Like, I'll probably just, like, we'll see. I might not bring a setup.
Yeah, well, we can plan for next year.
Yeah.
But there was definitely, like, a lot of, well, small stuff we did in order to make it more Melee-centric or for us. One thing, ironically, by not bringing the setup, we had to play friendlies over there. Secondly, is that we pretty much, like, a lot of the friendlies we played, we were all at separate tables.
Yeah, we weren't just playing with each other the whole time. Yeah. That was good. That was really good.
Thirdly, we watched only Melee. There were some, the previous 2 years, we watched a little bit of 64, a little bit of Smash 4. And then I think using those 2 years of experience, we came to a pretty good conclusion. Let's just watch Melee.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still remember there's a video I sent to Lucas. It was a Snapchat video. So we were both in the audience, and in front of us, I think 64 finals. Yeah. So I look over because I personally wasn't enjoying the 64 finals. If you enjoyed it, that's good for you.
It's one of those things where it's like,
yes,
I'm not going to shit on the games like 64 and Ultimate. Yeah. I think, like, I don't like them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like playing them. I like playing Melee, but that doesn't mean you can't like them. You know what I mean?
So,
I mean, like Melee.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So 64 is on the big screen. I'm not reeking into it, but other people are. That's okay. I turn over to Lucas. I just see him watching Melee on his phone.
Yeah, I was watching Melee on the Twitch. I was
just like, brah, there's a Melee setup. Like, just get up, walk 5 minutes. I know you can walk like 10 times that. Just do that and then sit down to Melee. So, yo, this tournament, I believe
I was trying to chill with the homies.
Yeah. But even the homies were like, yeah, this isn't cool at all. Let's just go. I think Mikey, what's funny is that at the beginning of the trip, Mikey was like, yo, 64 is actually kind of hype. Like, come watch it with me, guys. And then there was, we had to go through like 3 rounds of Puff versus Pikachu, where I think on Dreamland, because, you know, 64 has no other stages, where they were just like, hate each other, run away, hate each other, run away. It was just a slow game. At the end, Mikey was like, I'm never watching 64 again.
So, oh, man, that game is slow.
I mean, ironically, 64 isn't slow. It's, like, too fast because it's so easy to get combo from zero to death that everyone needs like 5 lives and everyone's too scared because one mistake and yeah, they literally zero to
it's
death.
It's like the neutral's really slow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why I like the, I prefer 64 combo videos. I think it takes the good thing about 64, the very hard-hitting, long-lasting, like, clever combos. It only focuses on that.
Yeah.
And then for Ultimate, Brawl, and Smash 4, they're just a tad bit too slow for me.
Yeah.
Especially Ultimate. I'm kind of a believer that a lot of the problems with Ultimate is that people recover too well, which is boring because sometimes when you do a good combo and you hit someone, you should be rewarded for that good combo. Mm-hmm. But then they just like jump once or twice, do the recovery move, and then they're back on stage. I don't know. It's like watching you have two expert fencers and you give them a toothpick and you're like, yo, fight with this. Obviously, all these players are skilled. It's just that the setting of the game kind of makes it that their four is a bit slow.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think the reason why I like this more is because we focus only on Melee.
Leffen versus Salem was hype, though.
Oh, my God.
I don't think you got to watch it, right?
No, but I watched it afterwards. Yeah.
That's when your phone broke.
So, for all... those who don't know, another reason why this Smash Town was good is that we had some top tier inside jokes. One of which was I broke my phone because I rolled a one on
accuracy.
Accuracy or precision, put my phone on the table. Well, put my phone on the table in air quotes. I more sort of just like put the top like
the top third on the table, and it fell off onto the concrete.
Yeah, so
and
that,
it destroyed the screen.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure a crack of the screen. I'm not sure you're allowed to put like podcast pictures on or how that works, but
I can put one.
The
yeah.
crack is like the top two thirds of the screen.
Yeah,
and like the only part that isn't cracked is like the bottom like outline, not like the screen itself, but like the bottom like outline near the home button.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was really sad. Let's just say that my mentality or my mental strength in playing games kind of took a huge plummet, like my phone did.
Yeah.
And I could not play very well at all.
It was so funny.
Let's keep this podcast PG, safe for work. I might have gotten very mad and cursed out both the host Lucas and our friend Jimmy.
That was
badly.
So funny. That was so funny. I accidentally unplugged you mid match. You stood up. I'm done. That was so funny. And then there was also we spent a lot of time in the arcade, which was great.
Yeah, definitely.
This leads me to another point that we have to talk about, and that is game design. Because honestly, to wrap up SmashCon, we had some top tier memes, and we spent a lot of time on Melee. It was so much fun. There was the power-up.
Yeah.
And then we get to the arcade. And Andrew and I, we beat House of the Dead 4.
Yeah.
What a game.
I think we joined a little bit late because there's like...
Stage 2.
Yeah. But honestly, we saw Stage 1 when Andre and
Jimmy played
Jimmy
through.
Played
they it. Actually beat it. Yeah, too. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, stage one, I don't think we missed too much, except the boss looked like a lot harder than the stage two and three bosses. But that besides that, yeah, we pretty much played the whole game.
Yeah.
So, game design, what do you want to ask me?
How do physics work? Because...
Depends on the game engine, man.
Well, in real life, what I can do is I can just, at a full speed moving train, right? I can just jump out and roll. I can just parkour roll and survive, right?
So, context for the people who are confused and also for people considering jumping out of a moving train.
Don't do that. Don't do it.
don't do it because it will hurt. Even a slow-moving train, like, don't do it. But during the game House of the Dead, the two protagonists were on a train barreling down to oblivion. And they're like, we have to jump. No, it's too dangerous. It's our only way out. They proceed to jump out of the train onto like the hard subway concrete floor. And for some reason, rather than having all their like momentum or carried. I guess velocity conserved, they just hit the ground and immediately slow down to a normal roll.
That's a famous case in physics too. Galileo was so confident in that he never even tested it.
I know, man. I mean, don't you just love it when momentum is not conserved at all and you're able to jump out of a moving train? Yeah.
That game was fun. But the design was kind of weird and
BS at the end.
And was BS at the end.
Yeah. So first off,
that's what made me convinced that it's an arcade game that you play for money.
Yeah. So for a very common trick in arcade games, and I'm sure a lot of you guys who go into arcades know, is that, once again, it is a business and they want to take money from you.
Yeah.
So they have to make the game hard. The hard being the fact that the harder it is, the more quarters you put in to keep playing, thereby making more money.
Fake difficulty.
Yeah. The thing is that you can either have two ways to make it hard. You can make it hard through clever game design and make it actually genuinely hard. But that's not fun because that means that if you're a truly skilled player...
You can beat it without paying more money.
Yeah. They're like, nah. Let's do fake difficulty stuff. Stuff where like, even if you're good, you can still just fall over because it's so hard that you have to be like perfect or just know the stupid trick and be forced to put in money. So... here's what we're talking
There
were
a couple
about.
Egregious cases in House of the Dead 4.
Yeah. No, so some examples that for some of the bosses, how they work is that they attack at you. And your goal is that you have to deal, so like they have like a mini health bar. You have to, if you deal enough damage to the mini health bar, it cancels their attack so you don't get hurt. That's basically your way of like quote unquote defending.
Yeah.
Now, in general,
offense is the best defense.
I think Sun Tzu said that. Yeah, he actually, maybe he did. I never read.
I read it. I read Art of War. I don't remember that. He said attack positions, only attack positions you know that you can defeat, and yeah, only defend positions you know you can defend.
Wow, shoot. That sounds genius. He was ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
No, but so the general idea is that like when the boss has attack, you have like a short time frame. I think like 4 or 5 seconds is like kind of it. In that 4 or 5 seconds, you have to basically deplete like the mini health bar in order to have his attacks canceled. Now, generally, the idea is supposed to be that like in 4 or 5 seconds, you can only output so many bullets because you know you got to click, 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 click the thing, right? And you also ideally have to aim, right? So hopefully, if it was well designed, it should be done in such a way that you can like make some mistakes, but as long as you were like still mostly accurate, you should be able to like do it within that 4 or 5 second time frame. The problem is that in the later boss, it required you to be perfect.
Yeah.
As in like
absolutely perfect.
Yeah. As in like Lucas and I, we will like fire into like the right target and try to deplete the mini health bar. It will only go halfway and then the attack will hit us.
Yeah.
And then we're like, wait, no, we were confused. We're like, we were clicking on it, right? We were shooting the right places.
Yeah.
So then we kept going. And the closest we got was like, we got down to like a tenth, like all the way to the last 10%, and they still like get us.
Yeah.
And that was with us like trying very hard to like make sure we were accurate and clicking as fast as we can.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that point where like, dude, we just got to be perfect at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of like BS, because that means that is, like I said, you just have to put in more quarters to get a lot of the practice in.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you have to be perfect.
Yeah.
But a well-designed game, on another note, is Half-Life. And this is something I kind of want to talk about, because one thing I'm pushing you to do, I don't know if you have shown some interest.
Yeah.
And that is, I want you to start doing like video game breakdowns. And for those of you who don't know, one of my favorite YouTube channels is Joseph Anderson. If you know who Joseph Anderson is, you know. And you know why he's the best. And it is because he does not do... Andrew, you're better at describing this. He does not do video game reviews.
He does video game analysis.
Yeah.
He breaks the game down. And when I say breaks it down, I mean he plays through a game 3 times.
Minimum.
Yeah. Like 3 or 4 times. And then during his review, he goes like step by step, like this sort of like set piece to the next set piece to the next set piece.
He surgically dissects the game.
The way I describe it is that like, if you never played the game before, don't watch his video if you have any interest, because once you watch it, you feel like you've played the game.
Yeah.
There's
no point in playing the game. You know everything about the game.
Yeah. And so I really respect his breakdown, because it's basically one step up from like a cursory review and something more akin to like, I don't want to say like a research paper, but more something of that like density of information, I guess, which I really do appreciate. One of his favorite videos of mine is his Fallout 4 videos,
yeah,
where he pretty much breaks down the whole story and like a lot of the gameplay.
He breaks
play,
down
design
the story,
choices.
Mechanics, design choices.
Yeah. And the reason why Lucas has been edging me towards that is because I've recently began to
also
replay.
In Fallout 4, this is the reason he's so good, before we get to you, is that he on top of that, when the DLC came out, he felt that the game had changed so much that he had to play through the entire game again and re-review the game.
Yes. His Fallout, like the DLC review, was also like a re-review. Yeah, a re-review. Or like a looking back of his Fallout 4 review. That is
dedication.
Complete.
Yeah, absolutely complete.
Uh-huh.
But you've started playing Half-Life again recently.
Yeah, because, I don't know. I mean, I played Half-Life 1 and 2 a lot when I was young, in like middle school and early high school. But then I stopped. And I guess I just had like a weird nostalgic feeling, especially because on the Steam sale, there were like $5 for everything. And it's like, that's so
cheap.
Why
not? It's $5.
Yeah. And playing through it, there are actually a lot of small, subtle game designs that I didn't notice when I was like younger, that I notice now. And I really do appreciate them. There are also some like severe game flaws that I also like to point out.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is really like interesting, cool, like seeing how the developers had thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to hear one?
Yeah, obviously.
Okay,
anything, Andrew, anything you got for me. I'm excited.
So something I noticed playing through Half-Life 1 is that during the early game, there were a lot of first aid kits. I remember there were some parts where you go to one room, there's a first aid station, and then immediately in the next room, there's another first aid station, right?
Mm-hmm.
But during like the later half of the game, first aid stations become a bit more and more rare. And at first, I thought this is probably just like a natural difficulty thing, like
yeah,
that. But then I realized that I thought a bit more about it, and that really didn't make a lot of sense because, I don't know, I feel like the enemies also got harder too.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a while to like try to put this into thought.
That's
I thought, cut this part out of the podcast. We're going to go into a different example.
That's really funny because we're not going to do that.
No, don't do that. I want to do a review such that I actually like do some deep thinking into it. So putting into words like kind of on the spot is not going to do well. So I'm going to go jump to a more recent example.
Yeah,
I showed today. I was playing through Half-Life 2, and something I noticed in Half-Life 2 versus Half-Life 1 is that in Half-Life 1, the first enemies you encounter are aliens.
Yeah.
But in Half-Life 2, the first enemies you encounter are the human, like, civil protection units. So they're basically, like, they're not, like, soldiers, but they're sort of, like, cops, I guess you would say.
They're the head authority.
Yeah. And that's actually interesting because fighting against aliens versus fighting against, like, cops in Half-Life 1 versus Half-Life 2 are very different feelings. So when you fight against the aliens in Half-Life 1, a lot of them are mostly melee combatants. So, for example, the headcrab, the hound eye, the bull squid, the headcrab zombies,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them have to walk up to you and hit you, which is good because that means that if you were far away, you could just like pow, pow, pow as they're like walking towards you. And you'll be, frankly, fine. It wasn't like the longest range enemy you saw back then with a Vortigaunt, but even then, it wasn't too bad because in order for them to attack you with electricity, they had to charge for like half a second or a second, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that gave you like a tough time, and it was very noticeable. It wasn't like they were just standing there, and all of a sudden electricity came at you. It's like they hunched over, a bright green electric like effect was playing around their body. It will play like a distinct growling sound with like crackling electricity. So it was something that you noticed right away. It wasn't until the level, I believe, we got hostiles. I say like 5 chapters in-ish of the 13 chapters in Half-Life 1. This one I might be wrong here, but where you actually fought against human soldiers and human soldiers are different because on one hand, you don't have that range advantage anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They can shoot you from far away. And secondly, the way they shoot you is instant because they use hit scan bullets. So I believe against Half-Life, like against the Vortigaunts, if you were fast enough, you could dodge their electrical attacks.
Okay.
Now, against human opponents, though, that could shoot at you, you can't dodge as easily. Mm-hmm. Because it's hit scan, so that means it flies faster at you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do miss. I think like the AI, they don't track you perfectly because that'd be a hard game.
But
you
had to be fake difficulty.
But you had to change your playstyle up. Half-Life 2, though, your first enemies were basically these cops that had guns and could shoot you,
mm-hmm.
and that changed it up because that meant that like you didn't have like the range luxury advantage you had from Half-Life 1.
Yeah.
And I actually find that cool because if you consider the context, Half-Life 1 was sort of like one of the first like big FPS game that was made. So I could kind of see how it would be like if you were like a new player, you've never seen a first-person shooter genre, or you've only like played a little bit of Doom, right? It might be a bit hard to basically say, here, we're going to make you fight a bunch of like soldiers that have guns that can hit you from far away.
Yeah.
So that means that if you couldn't aim at them, but they could aim at you, you were basically would like suffer.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that sort of like pushed Valve to design the game such that the first enemies were melee combatants. Because the thing about melee is that, let's say you can't aim very well. Well, if you miss a couple shots, that's fine because they can't hurt you. They still have to approach you. And the thing is that as it got closer to approaching you, it's easier to hit them.
Mm-hmm.
But with Half-Life 2, since at this point, it was released in 2004, there were a number of like very good shooters made in between then, like Halo 2 and I believe Halo Combat Evolved, that Valve was able to be like, listen, at this point, most people probably know how to shoot, how to fight against like ranged combatants. So we can start the game out like that way.
Oh, okay. They kind of assumed that people would be playing the first one.
I don't want to say like what Val was thinking because I can never assume. But this is like just something interesting I noticed. And it's also because of that design choice that it's changed like the setting of each game.
Yeah.
Half-Life 1 is like a very...
Oh, this is a big one. I think I've seen a video on this where it's like more open, right? Yeah. Or Half-Life 2 is, right?
Half-Life 1 is a very confined... scary game. Scary in quotes because
you could play it now and not be scared.
But the thing is that when you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
How do I say this? So the interesting thing about a video game is that video game enemies behave like enemies rather than living things. And what I mean is that in a lot of video games, when there's an enemy, their only goal in life is to kill you for some reason. Like, sometimes they'll avoid obstacles to protect themselves. They'll have, like, a sense of, like, self-preservation. Yeah. But what I mean is that if there's, like, an enemy, right, you blast him with a shotgun, he's at, like, 10 health, they, like, run away, but they'll always, like, keep fighting for something. They'll always search you out and kill you.
Yeah.
Half-Life 1 tried to change that up by making it more... They're not enemies out to kill you. They're wildlife. They're just acting naturally.
Okay.
And there's a very well-known Half-Life 1 YouTuber on YouTube. I believe his username is like Black Mephis, where he breaks down the AI of the Half-Life 1 like creatures, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of like subtle animalistic behavior that makes you, when you play, you might not know this, but you can see how they were going for, they're not enemies, they're wild animals type of things. A good example is the bull squid, right?
Yeah.
The bull squid is a very aggressive, like, two-legged dog that will pretty much always try to attack you. But if there's, like, raw meat in front of it, right, it actually will not attack you. It will slowly walk to the raw meat and eat it. Hmm. And then you can also stand right in front of it. I believe I sent you a video of that, right?
Yeah.
It was like in the freezer. And that's trying to give you an idea, like, this bull squid, he just wants food.
Yeah.
If there's food, he's not going to attack you. He's going to eat.
Yeah, interesting.
Another example is that enemies fight each other. When the soldier, like, if your presence isn't known and there's a soldier and he sees an alien, he will shoot the alien and then run in the direction of where the aliens are.
Oh, that was probably pretty revolutionary for the time.
Yeah, maybe. I wasn't born in like 19, like when Half-Life 1 was released, so I might not know. But you can kind of see that they're trying to go for these aren't enemies. You're an unfortunate scientist where like another world, the flora and fauna of another world has been teleported to yours.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like seeing the consequence of an invasive species. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which is very cool. I think in like a lot of Half-Life 1, there's like a lot of like they try to like have you look at the environment, look at the scenery, and you're like, yeah, things are just unfortunately teleporting, and they're like scared and just acting like wild animals. They're not out to get you. Half-Life 2 goes for more of a, the Earth has been fucked and you're under evil overlord, and pretty much all the people under the overlord are out to kill you.
What exactly happens in between Half-Life 1 and Half-Life 2?
So, after the run... Because
it starts out, you're on a subway, and then you go into the city.
Do you remember the general plot of Half-Life 1?
Half-Life 1, Freeman is a scientist.
Yeah.
And he is trying to escape the lab, Black Mesa, because...
He calls like a Renaissance Cascade, which basically is like when a bunch of shit goes down and aliens starts to teleport into the general area.
Yeah, and then he eventually teleports out to the alien homeworld, Zen.
He like kills the supposed leader who's like...
Sending
them
in.
Keeping it open. Yeah. So the plot...
That always confused me. So then he comes back, right?
Yeah.
I never knew like the in-between.
So there's like two parts to the plot. Problem is that Half-Life 3 will never be released. So we don't know the full story. But there's two sides going on. On Earth, basically what happens is that after Black Mesa had gone through the Renaissance Cascade, that certainly caused a sizable blip on like a radar with like space teleportation, and that led an alien empire known as a Combine.
Oh.
They basically saw this like Renaissance Cascade appear on their radar, and they were like, "There, we want to investigate this." So they come to Earth.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they come to Earth and they realize that there are a lot of sentient life on Earth, humans, and they say, "Okay, then, let's enslave these people."
Yeah,
and I think. I'm not, like, this one, I might be speculative. I'm not sure if they described it Half-Life 2, because I haven't beat Half-Life 2 yet. But I believe they were trying to copy Earth's teleporting portal technology.
Oh, okay.
Because if you're an empire, that would be such a useful thing to teleport long world. So they, basically, the Renaissance Cascade the Combine, like, it caught their attention on Earth. And they're like, here's something we want to investigate. They come to Earth and invade us. And in Half-Life 2, they describe this as the 7-hour war because they managed to conquer all of Earth in 7 hours. So then they pretty much enslaved us, and then they've been trying to like set up bases there. I think they've been trying to like find smart people and have them like develop technology for them. And then you're part of like... what's happening on Earth.
Yeah.
Then there's a second hidden story. We don't know who the G-Man is.
Yeah.
We just know that the G-Man is like an employee for like a shadow organization.
Yeah.
And he, for some reason, picks like very skillful people. He puts them in like, he uses them as like pawns in key places and have them carry out their order and put in like, so they have a goal in mind.
Yeah.
Doesn't
he carry like a spoon?
You mean a briefcase?
Yeah, in a briefcase. And in the briefcase is like a spoon and a pen or something.
I mean, that is true. I'm not sure if it's like a placeholder text.
Yeah.
Like some Valve employee was probably like, yeah, I'm just going to make the inside of a briefcase have a texture.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a joke. But that I cannot tell you. All I know is that basically he treats you like a pawn.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you're not so much a pawn as more like a, probably a higher ranking piece, like a knight, a rook, maybe even a queen.
Mm-hmm.
And he has some sort of end goal in mind. We don't know what it is. But he has an end goal in mind that involved actually causing the Renaissance Cascade. He was the one that caused it.
Oh, okay.
Because he gave the crystal sample that will basically cause the whole explosion. Hmm. He was the one that gave it to the scientist. So
when do you find that out?
I believe at the end of Half-Life 2, Episode 2. It's hard to tell. I believe it's implied at the end of Half-Life 2, Episode 2, that he gave the crystal to like the scientist.
Yeah.
And then he whispered to Eli's ear, prepare for unforeseen consequences. And that's basically, and Eli was like, yeah, he said that to me all those years ago at Black Mesa.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure. Like I said, the problem is that he's very mysterious, very unknown, the G-Man is.
Yeah.
And since Half-Life 3 will never be released, we can only speculate on what his role was.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how like people are moving on, the speculations and theories are really all we have, and the people are just going to forget about it sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. That's a shame it's not coming out.
Yeah. No, but back to the original topic on game design, I'm wondering if perhaps the design choice of having like melee enemies be your first encounter enemies and cops being your like first encounter enemies in Half-Life 1 and 2 respectively, like it pretty much helps set up like the atmosphere of the whole game.
Yeah, like what you'll be dealing with.
Yeah.
Because don't you primarily fight the Combine in Half-Life 2?
Yes. The only time I think you like fight the zombies like on a large like scale is Ravenholm.
Yeah, because they're not the main enemy anymore, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think after that, pretty much, you do sometimes encounter headcrabs or zombies, but they're like dark alleyways and sewers that you go into like for a little bit.
Yeah.
Pretty much the most common enemy in Half-Life 2 are basically the Combine soldiers.
Hmm.
Half-Life 1 is actually interesting because the enemy progression goes from the aliens to human soldiers,
yeah,
back to the aliens.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of want to do like
there's a bunch of chapters where you fight just human soldiers, right?
Yeah.
You don't see any aliens.
Yeah.
Or very few.
I believe in We Got Hostiles, it was mostly soldiers. Actually, and then there was this one brief chapter, Surface Tension, where it was both aliens and soldiers like at the same time, but they're also fighting each other.
Yeah.
Like, that was a point where they're pretty much trying to let you know this is a war zone.
Yeah.
The soldiers have arrived to Black Mesa. The aliens, now that they're like, they're no longer like confused wildlife aliens, but they're actually like militarized aliens with a goal of like landing on Earth and taking over. Like that part of the game, you could see they were going for like, it's a war zone out there. Because there are many times where you see the aliens and the soldiers outright fight each other.
Oh, okay.
And you also see a lot of like scripted scenes where it's like a soldier getting hurt by an alien or like a bunch of soldiers are bombing the aliens out.
Mm-hmm.
I really love Half-Life 1 because you're not like the hero. You're just caught in the like
unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah. Like on part one or like the beginning, aliens are popping in. They're wildlife. You just want to get out. Like you don't want to fight these wildlife. They don't even really want to fight you. But they're wildlife, escape, they're scared. Yeah. Then soldiers come. You don't know what's going on, so you try to just outright avoid them. Like, yeah, you do have to kill them sometimes, but you just want to learn like what is going on. Someone tells you, like, yo, soldiers are here to kill us. Then they're like, you gotta go meet a bunch of other scientists and like try to fix it all. And then at that point the aliens are coming in full force. You're just in the middle of a war zone. You're like, I just want to safely go from here to the scientists and stop this whole mess.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. And then Half-Life 2, it has like a similar story where like it changes. You're no longer the guy in the middle of like everything. You just want to go like from point A to point B. Like you're the hero, the one free man. And everyone, all the rebels glorify you. Every time they see you, they're like, Mr. Freeman, can we help you? Or like, oh, thank God Mr. Freeman's here. And all the Combine soldiers villainize you.
Yeah, they're really looking to get you. You're the main you're the main target.
There are like three or four times in the game where you will go enter like a security room, right? And there'll be like a television. It will play like the main human overlord who's working for the Combine, Dr. Breen.
Yeah.
He would just go on like a video rant like saying, listen, don't, like, if you're a citizen, do not try to help the free man because he is trying to ruin
our society and everything that's going on.
And if you're a Combine soldier, if you do not hunt him down, you'll be severely punished. This happens like three or four times.
Yeah.
And it's so like interesting because they're like, you're basically treated as like a god. On one side, you're treated as like an evil, like an evil force destroying everything. While on the other side, you're like the messiah who's going to
save everything and free everybody.
Yeah, to free them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also see like that. You also see that through like how the love of design worked, too. So during like the first game, you were trying to keep a low profile, just safely make it.
Yeah.
Like some people, a lot of the citizens do know you, but only the ones that are already like part of the in group, or they're ones receiving orders, right? Yeah. It wasn't until after Nova Prospect where you caused like a huge win for the humans that at that point you started meeting a lot more rebels, and yeah, a lot of them were like, yo, we're going to fight with you to like death, basically.
Oh, okay.
And it pretty much like
you and it kind of degrades into a war at the end of episode or at the end, yeah, of Half-Life 2.
I mean, I think it's interesting because the first enemies you see in like Half-Life 1 are cop level enemies. They're, yeah, only equipped with pistols and SMGs. It isn't until my memory is like foggy, but I believe once you get out of Ravenholm that you encounter actual like soldiers.
Yeah.
So now you're carrying like, they have rifles, they have shotguns, they have grenades.
Oh yeah,
because
you get some better
grenades
weapons at that time too, don't you?
What was that?
You get some better weapons at that time.
Yeah.
Too.
And that's basically the game saying like, hey, you used to be like a small like suspect that they were only sending cops after you. Now we're sending the military after you.
Yeah.
And then once you go through Nova's project, it caused a huge win. They're like, now we gotta send all our military, not just to stop you, but to stop all of the rebels.
And what happens in the beginning then? So you come through the subway, and then eventually you meet your friend, right?
Yeah.
Is he sneaking you into the city?
Basically, yes.
How come? Oh, because have they been hunting you from the beginning?
They have not been hunting you from the beginning. They actually don't know who you are, really, because I'm assuming Gordon Freeman, if you ever seen him, he looks pretty like he just has
generic,
like a beard and glasses. I believe what's happening is that they were selecting some humans to perform research on.
Yeah.
And you were just unluckily chosen, but Barney happened to just be there and catch you.
Oh, okay. No.
The thing with the G-Man is that he's very clever about where he puts his pieces. He put you in the right position that it seems like blind luck.
Yeah.
But he chose like that day.
Oh, no, okay.
Even a lot of the characters say stuff like, it's so convenient you showed up on this day because this is happening.
What happened again? So
first off, you were there when Barney was working his shift.
Yeah,
so
that's important. That's,
yeah, he was a friend that could catch you. If it was any other like undercover rebel, they probably would not have found you. Secondly, it was a day where the rebel had a working teleporter that could teleport people from like secret bases in the city,
yeah,
to an outside like rebel hideout.
Yeah.
Because they said that the original way that citizens would escape the city is that they had to go like an underground railroad.
Yeah.
Which is very dangerous because, you know, you were caught in the railroad. Not only would you likely be incarcerated and potentially killed, but then they'll also discover everyone else in the railroad.
Yeah.
So basically,
like a whole network.
Yeah. So basically, you arrived there on the day that they had a working teleporter.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the teleporter like fails.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though. Okay, when the teleporter fails, it didn't just like fail. Do you know where it teleported you to first?
It teleported you in the room of the guy.
Yeah, of the antagonist. And then he was like, "Wait, this is Gordon Freeman," and teleports like you back. So you could kind of see how which basically causes everyone in the city, all the police in the city, to like panic and start to search for you.
Oh, okay. And that's, yeah, what kickstarts it.
Yeah. We could kind of see that like the G-Man chose to put you on that day at that time so that you will find your friend and basically get basically like reveal yourself right,
yeah,
in front of the administrator, but like still leave yourself to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's just like, if the G-Man just left you right in front of Dr. Breen, you probably just get shot right there.
Yeah.
So that was like actually very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think a big part of the story of Half-Life 1 is that you're never really in charge of your own decisions.
Yeah.
I used to make fun of Half-Life 1's level design Half-Life 1 and Half-Life 2's level design because I said how the levels are designed in such a way that they wouldn't make sense for a normal facility. For,
yeah,
example, do you think a normal facility has a room with, like, imagine a really tall room, right?
Yeah.
They have boxes hanging from the ceiling. Yeah. Does that really make sense?
No, what's the use in that?
I don't think there is a use, actually. Or, no, there's another one. They have a freezer, right?
Yeah.
But there's no garage door for trucks to come in. It's like an isolated freezer. So, like, how do you get the meat? The only way to get the meat in there is you have to carry it through the offices.
Yeah.
No, like, I used to make fun of a lot of these Half-Life 1 and 2, like, level design. But it really helps you, gives you the feeling that you really don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
You're like a pawn in someone else's game. The mm-hmm. G-Man's game.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Now, for all I praise I give to Half-Life 1 and 2, there is some problem. The fake difficulty. Don't play Half-Life 1 or 2 on hard difficulty. Because there was one video I sent Lucas. So
yeah.
There's a normal human soldier, right? And why is it human soldier? I mean, like, there you see some enemies, they're like 7 foot tall. They're like, have a lot of muscles. They're huge. And they wear a lot of armor.
Yeah.
Think of the brutes from Halo. If you ever played that, right?
Yeah.
So, not those enemies. These are normal human soldiers, right?
Yeah.
I managed to sneak behind one, pull out my shotgun. I'm right behind him, point blank. I shoot him in the head. What does he do? He turns around and proceeds to empty his SMG into me and then throw a grenade right at me point blank. And I'm just standing there like, I'm just standing there like so confused that I just die.
Yeah.
The reason why I don't like that is because that is fake difficulty. If I, as a player,
am able to sneak up onto an AI and able to kill it, you should be rewarded for that.
With like an instant kill.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense at all. It pretty much means that like the best way to win is you always have to like just use all your strongest moves and play very safe.
Yeah.
Because why play risky? Why like play risky and sneak around if when doing so, I still can't kill them that quickly?
Yeah.
It's like a very high risk, low reward gameplay.
Yeah.
So yeah, mm-hmm. don't. Half-Life 1 and 2 are slightly not well-balanced when it comes to the hard difficulty.
Yeah.
Enemies become bullet sponges, and it's just unfair.
It's a common problem.
Yeah. It's not the change in tactics. It's just that, like, they just are harder to kill.
Yeah, that's a shame. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. A really good example I like to give for, like, what fake difficulty is that, imagine Mario just like a Goomba, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a Goomba. Now, 9 times out of 10, you're going to stomp on that Goomba.
And not make any mistakes whatsoever. Yeah. Because now, it's an easy enemy that you can get by.
Now, let's say there's a 1 in 10 chance you like, accidentally walk into the Goomba. Like, you weren't thinking. Mm-hmm. You were having a small, like, a brain fart, and you die. You lose a life, right?
Yeah.
Fake difficulty would say this. Yo, how about every time you die to a Goomba, you lose 10 lives?
Yeah, because...
like, it's not... that much harder to jump over the Goomba or kill the Goomba. But on that 1 in 10 times you do make that mistake...
you lose 10 lives.
Yeah. A better way, difficulty, will be to have a Goomba differently.
Yeah, I feel like fake difficulty is like almost an arbitrary type thing, where it's not an actual change to the game or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's almost, like you said, like losing 10 lives in that situation or something.
Yeah. Actual difficulty increase will be either... you have different types of Goombas.
Yeah.
So maybe like a red Goomba, he sometimes spurs into flames, so you can't jump on him. A blue Goomba, he himself like jumps into the air.
Yeah.
So if you mistime your jump and he jumps too, you get hit. It's stuff where...
it changes the way that you have to play the game and focus and everything.
Yeah. I guess here's a way to say. If you have to stop and think like, okay then, do I have to try a new strategy? That's probably, like, good difficulty. If you could do the same thing, you just have to do more of, like, the exact same thing, and you really don't think of anything differently, is fake difficulty.
Yeah.
A lot of the enemies, like, in Half-Life 1 and 2 on hard difficulty, they're not much harder to fight. Now,
they
just, like...
they don't really change their AR or anything.
Yeah.
They just make it so that you just have to shoot them more.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they behave slightly... differently. I personally have not yet
seen a
noticed.
Difference or anything.
Yeah, like I'm doing the same tactics of just like trying to like take cover and like take shots. It's just that I have to do that more often now.
It just seems like it just seems like it slows you down a little bit more, and that also again, you just have to use more bullets so that that also becomes a part. That becomes an enemy then, too. It's like, how much ammo do you have and everything?
I also don't like fake difficulty because it sometimes makes the game less... it's not just it makes a game have, no more strategy. It can actually make a game less strategic.
Yeah.
And here's an example. Let's say you have a game where you have two types of enemies, right?
Yeah.
You have a bunch of tiny bug enemies that have low health, but are, they swarm you. And you have, one really strong enemy who's slow, but he can take a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And I give you two equipment in your arsenal. I give you a machine gun and a sniper rifle. Now, what do you think I give you two weapons and two enemies. Do you think you can make the connection?
Yeah. You would probably want to use one for one enemy, one for the other enemy.
Yeah. Now, let's say that I am a bad game developer. I'm yo, I've got to make things more difficult. Let's just make all of the enemies have more health.
Yeah. Which is it's difficult because you have to find the balance of where I increase their health a little bit, but maybe I change how they play on the hard difficulty.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of times what developers do is they just jack up the health a ton. It just makes the game slower.
Yeah. Now, in the first example, right, the idea is that if you have a bunch of weak enemies, you can use a machine gun and just shoot. That machine guns would be good against a bunch of weak enemies.
Yeah.
And the sniper rifle would be good against a one strong enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say that I increase the health of every enemy I triple their health, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you really can't use a machine gun on the weaker enemies anymore. You have to use, maybe you need a sniper rifle to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
By that one choice, I basically say you cannot use, weak damage but high ammo capacity weapons anymore.
Yeah.
You can now only use weapons with a lot of damage.
Yeah.
That kills off strategy
mm-hmm.
because of that. Or imagine you have an enemy that he's a huge bullet sponge, or every soldier in the game is a bullet sponge that can tank 4 or 5 shotgun blasts, and they can output a lot of damage.
It would just make the shotgun completely useless.
Yeah. Not only that, but it'd be you can't fight them head on. So what's the only thing you can do?
You have to run.
Stay far away. Yeah, hide or stay far away and shoot. Yeah. It kills strategy.
Yeah.
Because
it forces you to play a certain way instead of actually having you have to explore different ways of playing.
Yeah.
In order to find out what's the right way to play.
Yeah. So how will you increase difficulty? One way is to add a new enemy type or enemy variety.
Yeah, so that the player has to learn more mechanics.
Yeah. Or maybe change the AI up. Have it so that on easy difficulty, the soldiers are less like normal soldier, but on the hard, they take cover. They try get around it. Or another one can be that, let's say enemies do more damage. You also do proportionally more damage also.
Yeah.
So it becomes a very I'm a glass cannon, but the enemy is also a glass cannon.
Yeah.
So that means that I can still use my original strat. I just have to be more precise with my shots, but not to an outrageous level where I have to be perfect. Just still enough that I can take the enemy down.
You just have to think a little bit more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's not easy. Trust me. There are courses in game design I want to take. They're people go to school over this. So it's not easy. But I just think it's something I like to think about. You know
what absolutely.
I mean?
No, it's definitely something. No, I enjoy talking about it too. I enjoy hearing your breakdown because that's a lot of stuff that I haven't even thought about before.
Yeah, but that's why, even if I don't do a Joseph Anderson breakdown of Half-Life 2, I still want to do maybe a small Let's Play.
Yeah.
Because
I would like to see you do that. I would like to see you do 5-10 minute gameplay breakdowns of this is my favorite parts of the game. This is the issues that I saw. I think you'd be good at it.
Yeah.
And also it'd allow you the time to kind of work other things in as well.
Yeah.
Are you going to let us know when it comes out?
It might. I don't want to give any promises because I said, school is busy for me. So
you should do it, man.
I didn't want to do it. Perhaps something, a project I can work on over winter break.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. How you feeling, Andrew?
I am feeling pretty good. Yeah. My throat is a bit,
we've been grinding. We've been grinding. So how about that? We can close it out on that. How you feeling? Feel good with that? We hit all the topics we wanted to hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good one.
It's hard to say how on task we were because we had some moments where
we hit all our topics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is true too.
Well, Andrew.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
It was an awesome podcast. I appreciate it. And you'll be on again. You're a regular. You're officially a regular.
Yeah, I do agree wholeheartedly, my friend.
Thank you, homie. Love you. Bye, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. See you guys. Bye.